On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the pandemic has done a number on different sectors of the market, especially when it comes to cybersecurity, while some sectors are just not prepared, like the EDU. So we'll talk about that and what's going on there. Plus, is it time to be more intentional when it comes to fighting phishing attacks? Well, Curtis will take us through that. Plus, do you want to move to serverless technology? Well, there aren't many turnkey solutions out there to help you. We have a great guest CEO of Stackery, Tim Zonka. He's going to take us through some solutions on how to make it easy for your organizations to move to serverless. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 401, recorded July 10th, 2020. Just clouding around with serverless. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection to their servers so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/enterprise. And by IT Pro TV. Get the most up-to-date IT professional training with IT Pro TV. Visit itpro.tv/enterprise for an additional 30% off all consumer subscriptions for the lifetime of your active subscription. Use code ENTERPRISE30 at checkout. And by Barracuda. Did you know that 91% of all cyber attacks start with an email? To uncover the threats hiding in your Office 365 account, get a secure and free email threat scan at barracuda.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chiebert. Always amazing having you here. What's keeping you busy this week?
I'm actually going old school for some surveillance systems that I'm helping to retrofit. Seems there's an awful lot of analog surveillance cameras out in the world. And the problem is, as we start moving towards remote surveillance and, you know, AI and things like that, analog just doesn't cut it anymore. So I've been playing around with a bunch of Axis analog to digital converters. And funny enough, those actually work very, very well. And they even have a way of using the RS-485 to control the tilt, pan, and zoom and do it for a fraction of the cost of changing out all the cameras.
Don't you wish that's how all technology would be, is being finding solutions that's a fraction of the cost?
Yeah.
I wish that's the way it would always been. Well, thanks for being here, Cheever. Plus, we have our favorite enterprise and IT news journalist as well, Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, always great to see you, my friend. What's keeping you busy down there in Florida?
Well, it is great to be here, and I've had a great week that actually does a lot to explain why I love being a journalist so much. This week, I have had a conversation with someone who's using machine learning on hardware counters to do detection of various vulnerabilities. I've had a conversation with someone who's just written a brand new book on C language programming practices. And I've had a couple of great conversations that are going to lead up to a story on DJI drone security. So all that's been going on for me. Articles to come. Lots of fun here in Florida and at Dark Reading.
Looking forward to it, especially the DJI one. That caught my attention because I was thinking of getting one of those units. So we'll have to wait and see. Well, folks, it's been fairly busy in the enterprise news space this week, so we should get started for sure. Now, we all know that this pandemic's done a number on some different sectors of the market, and we've seen actually an increase in cyber attacks. However, some areas are not prepared as usual, like the EDU. We'll talk about that, what's going on there. Plus, we try to be intentional about learning something from experience, right? Well, maybe it's time We use that model to start fighting phishing attacks as well. Curtis will take us through that. Plus, your organization might want to take the shift to serverless technology, right? Well, unfortunately, there's not many turnkey solutions out there, and it's not easy as just uploading code to the internet. Now, we have a great guest to talk us through some solutions here. He's the CEO of Stackery, Tim Zonka, on the show, and we'll get through that as well. But first, it's been a busy week in the enterprise, so let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Now, the pandemic has driven the development of new markets all over the world. What if I told you it has also driven innovation in the biometric sensors as well, especially in digital door locks and in payments? Would you be surprised? Well, we'd love to hear from you on that. Now, you might ask, why is this market developing? Well, governments and public-private companies are looking into methods to reduce virus impact. An analysis of a global smart lock market done by Grandview Research says that forecasts the market, which has valued at $1.2 billion in 2019 on 7 million units sold, is going to grow to an 18.5% from 2020 to 2027. That's a large growth. Now, there are many use cases here that are causing the increase in usage. In fact, one surprising one is a surge for in-possession medication distribution lockers with biometric access connected to the prison scheduling system. That's an interesting one. To ensure social distancing, prisoners can take their medication without meeting with a nurse or doctor. Now, on the payment side, fingerprint cards has become the latest biometrics expert to point to the COVID-19 pandemic as an essential new factor driving interest in contactless biometric payment cards. Now, it's urging consumers to ask their banks for the next generation technology here. In addition to consumers being frustrated with having to remember a plethora of PINs and passwords, who wants to touch a screen or a pen used by hundreds, sometimes thousands of people? Well, as this year continues to evolve, so is the adoption of old and new technology to drive for better acceptance of its users. What is your organization doing here? We want to hear from you.
Well, researchers are using machine learning to foil facial recognition. Facial recognition is quickly becoming a disruptive and highly controversial technology with very few limits imposed by privacy policies. Academic researchers, however, have found ways to, at least temporarily, cause problems for certain classes of facial recognition algorithms, taking advantages of weaknesses in the training algorithm or the resulting recognition model. Last week, a team of computer science researchers at the National University of Singapore published a technique that locates the area of an image where changes can best disrupt image recognition algorithms, but where those changes are least noticeable to humans. Now, currently, researchers need to know the class of algorithm, and they can develop a solution for that, but they're working on techniques that would generalize the process to have one solution that would work for every class, both current and future. This research raises the possibility of creating photos that people can easily perceive, but that foil commonly used facial recognition algorithms. Turned into a filter, for example, the technique could allow users to add imperceptible changes to photos to make them more difficult for machine learning algorithms to classify and therefore foil the development of reverse image search engines. Even if the researchers do find an approach that could foil the most common approaches to facial recognition, though, the surveillance system makers would likely be able to find ways to work around the technology, say the researchers at the university. The best way to limit artificial intelligence, they say, is through policy rather than technology.
Well, Harvard and MIT are suing the Trump administration to block the deportation of their online-only students. Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology today sued the Trump administration to block an action that forces foreign students with non-immigrant visas to leave the United States or transfer to different schools that offer in-person classes. The school's complaint, filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Massachusetts, asked for a temporary restraining order and permanent injunction preventing the administration from enforcing the new policy issued by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. In the complaint, Harvard and MIT said, quote, "By all appearances, ICE's decision reflects an effort by the federal government to force universities to reopen in-person classes, which would require housing students in densely packed residence halls." notwithstanding the university's judgment that it is neither safe nor educationally advisable to do so, and to force such a reopening when neither the students nor the universities have sufficient time to react or to address the additional risks to the health and safety of their communities. The effect, and perhaps even the goal, is to create as much chaos for universities and international students as possible, unquote. The ICE policy will especially be problematic for Harvard and MIT students from certain countries such as Syria, where civil war and an ongoing humanitarian crisis make internet access and study all but impossible, according to the lawsuit. Others come from Ethiopia, where the government has a practice of suspending all internet access for extended periods, including presently starting on June 30th, 2020. The policy also bars F1 students who are currently outside the U.S. from entering or re-entering the United States. The bottom line is that this isn't just academics protecting their bottom line, but institutions protecting the students from losing all access to higher education because of conflict or policies in their home country.
Now, we all know organizations have moved to a more significant online presence, especially with an increased remote workforce. Now, online video has gotten pretty good over the last few years. However, what it could tell you is it will soon even get better. So stay tuned. Well, believe it or not, a German research institute recently announced a new video standard that halves the bit rate required for streaming. That's right, halves it. Now, allowing higher quality images on lower power devices and opening the door to a wider adoption of super high definition 8K content. Now, Fraunhofer Heinrich Hertz Institute, I'm not going to say that too many times, said the new codec, VVC, or versatile video coding, will not compromise video quality. So it's lossless here. Now, with ever-increasing demands on bandwidth for social media streaming, video conferencing, 4K content, and 360-degree panoramic videos, and especially during the heightened web usage spurred by global quarantines, VVC comes at a very convenient time. Now, let's put this into perspective for you. To obtain 8K quality streaming, current users would require internet connections of at least 85 megabits per second, which exceeds the capabilities of the capacities of many home internet. Now, but only half that rate would be necessary with VVC, only half. Now, this makes a new standard look actually pretty promising for mobile devices. Now, for instance, the previous standard, the H.265 or HEVC, requires 10 gigabytes of data to transmit a 90-minute UHD video. With this new technology, VVC, only 5 gigabytes of data are needed to achieve the same quality. Now, the previous standard had a pretty good run, 7 years, right? And at its original release, it had 2 times the increase in efficiency over its predecessor. So, obviously, it's only in good time that we have even more efficient standards here. Now, unfortunately, due to the complex royalty system surrounding that particular standard, it was marked by legal disputes, and it was actually hard to adopt. But VVC was designed in collaboration with Apple, Ericsson, Intel, Huawei, Microsoft, Qualcomm, and Sony, and it has set to be adopted by the Media Coding Industry Forum, comprising of 34 major companies. Now, by broad development, collaboration should also mean avoidance of some of those royalty issues posed by the original standard, the previous standard. Now, you might be saying, what's the catch here? There's got to be something, right? Well, there's always a catch with codecs and formats. Well, in this case, it's the challenge or that barrier of entry to get started with VVC. It's kind of high. Unfortunately, VVC demands greater processing power. Its decoding process is up to 10 times more complicated than HEVC. Now, the code encoding process, too, is lengthy. In fact, the VVC research team that tested VVC found it took 6.5 times longer to encode VVC content than under the current standard. That means that new silicon might be required to encode and decode the content efficiently and smoothly. Now, this means the current devices might not be enough to bring this standard to the forefront. Plus, we must not forget there's already a competitor to VVC out there that's actually an alternate standard. Now, AV1 is an open source standard code, and its code is open source. Now, although it's not as powerful as VVC, but it is actually still a 30% more efficient than the current HEVC standard. Plus, AV1 has been adopted by several major media players, including YouTube and Netflix. Now, if nothing else has come out of the global tech market this last quarter, it has been researching and developing new standards to better the remote and isolated public. Look out for new and better video standards to a device near you.
Well, a new study has found 15 billion stolen or exposed credentials in criminal markets. Cybercriminals looking to hijack online accounts belonging to consumers and organizations have an almost unlimited supply of stolen and exposed credentials they can use to try and facilitate the takeover. New research by Digital Shadows uncovered a stunning 15 billion credentials circulating on the dark web and in underground marketplaces. The compromised credentials from over 100,000 breaches in recent years were associated with a wide range of accounts, including domain administrator accounts, bank and financial records, and social media and video streaming service accounts. Now, the prices in the criminal marketplaces for these credentials ranged from an average of more than $3,000 for domain admin accounts to $70 and change for bank accounts, $21 and change for account access for antivirus programs, and less than $10 for credentials to adult sites. Usernames and passwords for video game accounts and file sharing sites, well, those were available for less than $2 a pop. Now, organizations can take multiple measures to mitigate their exposure to account takeover attacks. Among them is the need to monitor for leaked employee credentials via sites such as Have I Been Pwned and for mentions of the organization or brand on criminal forums.
Hong Kong is downloading Signal as residents fear crackdowns. The secure chat app Signal has become the most downloaded app in Hong Kong on both Apple's and Google's app stores, according to a Bloomberg report citing data from App Annie. The surging interest in encrypted messaging comes days after the Chinese government in Beijing passed a new national security law that reduced Hong Kong's autonomy and could undermine its traditionally strong protections for civil liberties. The 1997 handover of Hong Kong from the United Kingdom to China came with a promise that China would respect Hong Kong's autonomy for 50 years following the handover. Under the terms of that deal, Hong Kong residents should have continued to enjoy greater freedom than people on the mainland until the year 2047. But recently, the mainland government has appeared to renege on that deal. Civil liberties advocates see the national security law approved last week as a major blow to freedom in Hong Kong. The New York Times reports that the four major offenses in the law, separatism, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign countries, are ambiguously worded and give the authorities extensive power to target activists who criticize the party, activists say. Until now, Hong Kongers face trial in the city's separate independent judiciary. The new law opens the door for dissidents to be tried in mainland courts with less respect for civil liberties or due process. This has driven heightened interest among Hong Kongers in secure communications technology. Signal offers end-to-end encryption, is viewed by security experts as the gold standard for secure mobile messaging, and it was endorsed by the NSA whistleblower Ed Snowden. Well, this is just an example of free speech being protected by technology. Very similar to the use of fax machines during the Tiananmen Square protests of yesteryear.
Now, organizations are always looking to geolocate their assets to ensure better compliance, data sovereignty, and even performance in their online services and applications. However, this year has been nothing short of strange and odd for businesses and their decision-making in the space. Now, according to the recent news, Google has abandoned plans to offer a significant expansion of new cloud services in China and other politically sensitive countries. Now, this looks to be primarily due to concerns over geopolitical tensions and the pandemic, according to some employees who were familiar with the matter. This has definitely been revealed as challenges for U.S. tech giants to secure business in those markets. Now, in May, the search giant shut down the initiative known as Isolated Regions, which actually sought out to address nations' desires to control data within their borders. Now, the action was considered a massive strategy shift, according to one of their employees, who said Isolated Region had involved hundreds of workers scattered around the world. Now, Google is pouring money into cloud computing, part of the broader effort to find new growth sources beyond searching advertising. Now, Google Cloud generated $8.9 billion in revenue in 2019, a 53% increase over the previous year, as it has pushed into sectors such as finance and government that require special security clearance and features that shield confidential data. Now, rivals like Microsoft and Amazon already offer these capabilities via their cloud units. Now, Google's recent decision to nix the isolated region project has made it partially or partly because of global political divisions, which were exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the two employees who requested to name anonymous here. Now, Google's official stance here is that the canceling of isolated region was because of, quote, the other approaches that they were actively pursuing, which offer better outcomes. Now, this plan to bring services to these markets started 2 years ago, so it seems less likely that the project stopped due to, quote, other approaches. Now, Google's competitors in this space, such as Amazon Web Services and Azure, have dominated the market in recent years. Now, cloud regions let companies offer the horsepower and security of the multiple data centers in that region. Now, Microsoft has more than 60 cloud regions globally, more than double AWS and Google. Now, Google spokeswoman said that the company defines regions differently than the other companies. Hopefully, this is not a message that Google has given up on its global service presence and commitment to growing its global cloud offerings. We'll have to see. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's ExpressVPN. Now, you know, when I travel for business, I need a way to ensure that my data is safe no matter what internet connection I'm using, no matter which one. Like you and me, we probably hop between Wi-Fi networks, whether we're abroad or out on, you know, even just out in the car somewhere. And sometimes you tether your device to a hotspot that you may be unfamiliar with, that network might be unfamiliar. My question to you is, what better way to ensure your security and privacy when you're on those types of networks or even at home than by using ExpressVPN? Now, when I use it, I don't even know I'm using it anymore because of the number of global nodes they have and the speed of their network. Now, the latency is so low, I don't even notice I'm using it anymore, especially when I'm watching videos. That's great. Now, I know most of you are probably thinking, why don't you just use incognito mode, like, right? Let me tell you something. Incognito mode does not hide your activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browser history. Your internet service provider can still see every single website you visit. That's right. That's why even when I'm home, I never go online without ExpressVPN. Now, it doesn't matter if you get your internet from Verizon or Comcast or any other local ISP. ISPs in the U.S. can legally sell your information to other companies, like ad companies. Now, ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure service so your ISP can't see the sites you're visiting, right? ExpressVPN also keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Now, most of the time, I don't even realize that ExpressVPN is on. It runs so seamlessly in the background. It's super easy to use, super easy to install, super easy to get up and running. All you have to do is tap one button and you're protected. Now, ExpressVPN is available on all your devices, your computers, even your smart TV. So there's no excuse for you to not be using it anymore. That's right. Protect your online activity today with the VPN rated number one by CNET and Wired. Visit my exclusive link, ExpressVPN.com/enterprise, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a 1 year package. That's ExpressVPN.com/enterprise. ExpressVPN.com/enterprise to learn more. And we thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, this first one is going to hit close to home, especially to one of our co-hosts here. Now, the education sector has always found it challenging to maintain the security of its services and systems. And it's a challenge for organizations that sometimes spend millions of dollars a year, let alone government funding technology. Now, let's face it, things are not always well funded for schools, right? Well, then steps in COVID-19 and throws another wrench into the wheel. Now, school districts in the United States already had significant cybersecurity shortcomings. They often lack dedicated funding and skilled personnel to continuously vet and improve cybersecurity defenses. Now, as a result, many schools make basic system setup errors or leave old vulnerabilities unpatched. Now, it's like them propping a back door open so hackers can get in. We don't want that to happen. Now, schools and students also face potential exposure from third-party education technology firms that actually fail to secure their data in their platforms adequately. Now, the pandemic amplified these risks. School districts around the country transitioned to distance learning in the spring. They kind of were thrown into it. And suddenly, millions of teachers and students relied on video chat software, lesson portals, digital messaging boards, and other online tools. And if these systems are set up without proper authentication controls, they can become vectors for attack. Now, tools to access to school networks remotely can also be a problem here, including VPNs, remote desktop protocols, can be abused by attackers to gain unauthorized access to sensitive systems. Now, last week, in fact, the Federal Bureau of Investigation issued a security alert about the threat of ransomware to schools amidst the COVID-19 crisis. Listen to this number. In the past 30 days, more than 4.7 million malware incidents were detected in the education industry broadly worldwide. Now, that is actually according to Microsoft's Global Threat Activity Tracker. Now, this is more than 60% of all the corporate and institutional malware incidents reported during that time, 60% of them. Now, the next most effective sector is what Microsoft calls business and professional services, with fewer than 1 million incidents. Now, many schools are ill-equipped here to securely migrate to completely digital learning experience. So it comes absolutely no surprise that these vulnerabilities are so visible to everybody. Now, I want to go to my co-host here. Cheebert, I want to go to you first because you have some deep experience in the education sector. And I want to kind of hand you a soapbox here for this bite and ask, is this your experience?
Oh, yeah, definitely. here's my soapbox. Schools are really, really bad because on technology adoption, because they're straitjacketed in policy. And these policies are being made by people that don't understand the rapidly changing technology business that we are in. So here's what happened to me personally. I was actually running a group within the University of Hawaii where we'd take discarded computers from the university and from the private sector. We would refurbish them and build labs and teach the PTA. Literally, we actually taught the PTA how to drop fiber in the ground so we could put a backbone in. And for one particular middle school, we managed to save them at least $100,000. Then came policy. The higher-ups said, no, we can't afford that. That's too much liability. Things like ditch witches and so forth are way too dangerous for the PTA to be running, even though they're being run by people that do this every day for a living, and shut us down. This was after building a lot of labs for different schools. And the sad part is this is not just in IT. I've had several PTAs tell me about how a professional plumbing company bonded and everything. The father of one of these girls in an elementary school volunteered to go and add a sink to help the elementary school teacher be able to do art lessons. But the school board said not only no, but heck no, and proceeded to go out to bid for a sink that cost an insane amount of money to be put in. This is what needs to be solved. Schools would probably get a lot more help if the school boards would work with the lawyers and try to deal with some of this liability issue. It's not that these people aren't bonded. It's not that these people aren't trustworthy. It's that the school boards are unwilling to work with the private sector to leverage what little budget money they have. You know, people are going to Chromebooks because they don't have the IT specialist, and Google has created Chrome as tailor-made for education, but they lose out on a lot of capabilities because Windows is perfectly capable of doing the same thing. So are Macintoshes. But anyway, I soapbox and soapbox and soapbox. It's time to let the other people have a word in sideways, but I really and truly think the answer to this isn't just technology, it's policy and the lack of it.
The good points there. I think, Curtis, I want to throw this to you because, you know, in the enterprise space, obviously a lot of organizations are handling a lot of this right now, a lot of services, and they have a lot of expertise there. Is there anything that the enterprise can do to help the EDU space here?
Well, I think there are some lessons, and some of them have begun to be learned by the educational space. For example, there are many ways in which moving things to the cloud can help because it frees up other resources to go ahead and look at these donated services. The big thing, though, is the fact that it has become so very difficult to have someone volunteer. And now, let me say that the last time I was doing a lot of this was somewhere close to 15 years ago, when my son was in high school. I was involved in the music program at his school. I was involved in the theater program. I'm a pianist and organist. I do accompanying of singers and productions. I also consulted on the technology advisory committees for the schools. And it reached a point where just to be able to be on campus, they were requiring extensive and, let me say, expensive background checking for any volunteer. It's a terrible dance that they have to do. And this is, again, something that enterprises can help with, because while a company has to feel confident in the security stance of anyone that it allows onto its corporate campus, schools have to do the same thing. And they have taken what is unfortunately a very common point of view, which is, we won't deal with the problem. We'll simply outlaw all participation. I think what they need to do, especially today, is figure out ways to deal with it, figure out where the risks actually lie, and sit there and find solutions. Unfortunately, in too many cases, figuring out where these risks lie involves taking away some profit potential for a handful of educational contractors. And therefore, you know, the economics and the justification for doing it can be hard to come by.
Makes sense. Now, Chubert, I want to throw this last one to you, because, you know, you said, hey, there is one thing they can do. What about training? What about if we train their users more? Because obviously, sometimes you have your weakest links in your system, and most of the time that's your users. Is the cheapest thing here maybe to just do a little training on some best practices here? Because I have personal experience here. I dealt with my three kids having to deal with online learning, you know, in the elementary space, and I can definitely tell you the teachers were just not ready. They just weren't familiar with the services and how to use them efficiently, securely. Is this something that they could do better that actually helps maybe alleviate some of this?
I think actually the answer needs to come from the teachers' unions. The reality that I've been working with is only a small, I mean really small number of teachers are willing to take an extra effort to go and get trained up on emerging technologies and emerging fields to enrich themselves. These teacher enrichment days are too far and few between. So one of the things that I challenge teachers to do is what you can work with the private sector. You have to be willing to use some of your enrichment days or enrichment hours that the unions do allow you to do and work with them. I know a lot of the private sector that would love to be able to help out, would love to do classes for you. But you got to keep in mind, these poor people have to make money too. And if you're going to demand that the private sector goes and does things during prime time, you know, when they're supposed to be on a 9-to-5 job, you're not going to have as many takers. But if you're willing to meet them halfway, do things like Saturdays or early evenings or maybe a potluck or a brown bag dinner. I've done that for a couple of schools, and the results have been stunning. There is ways to do this. It's just the sad part is teachers, you got to meet them halfway. I know you're underpaid. I know you're understaffed and all that. But if you want to get ahead of the game, maybe you need to take a page from some of the technology industries where you're constantly learning and you go and try and meet these professionals halfway so that they can help you help yourself.
Absolutely. I like that. I like that a lot. Thanks, Shubert. That's a good way to close out that bite. But we do have another bite. Now, we all try to be intentional about learning something from experience, but can it be more intentional when it comes to cyber insecurity? What do you think, Curtis?
We hope so. You know, here on TWIET, there is a friend of the show, Tim Titus, who talks about root cause analysis all the time. In science and engineering, root cause analysis is a method that's used to identify the main source of a problem. Engineers go in and don't worry about things like blame, but they ask questions to understand why an issue occurred. What happened? What went well? What didn't go well? Did we get lucky somewhere? What can we do to improve to avoid the problem happening next time? In doing all these things, the engineers collaborate on incremental tweaks to tools and processes. The key to all this is being intentional about learning something from the experience rather than assigning blame. In most security awareness programs, phishing exercises are part of the process. The problem is they usually lack intention, and there are many security professionals that will question their usefulness as they are generally performed. In many of these, security teams send email and check who opens them, clicks on links, shares passwords, and does other things. Why do they do this? Now, some people will argue that it's for compliance or to educate staff, and some say that it's to shame those who take the bait. Phishing exercises can be great things as long as we're intentional about why we're doing them. What if we went into these phishing exercises as intentionally as engineers go into root cause analysis? We would start by being intentional by deciding what it is we want to achieve through the effort. We're creating an exercise with a specific purpose in mind, not just to check a box. If we're not sure what the goals are, in other words, what changes we want to result from this, we should put some thought into why we're doing the exercise in the first place. Did some executive ask us to? Is it something that, well, we just do this once a quarter? Is it something that our compliance auditors require us to do? Why are we doing this? This thing that's certain is that we can create a more useful exercise if we're clear about our goals for doing so. We often talk about phishing exercises as something we're doing for our staff to educate them on what phishing looks like and to teach them what to do if they receive a suspicious email. With some advanced planning, though, and with a clear intention, we can use these exercises to the benefit of security. We can learn more about the people we support, learn how they work, learn what they need from the security staff. Let's face it, we cannot empower people to work in a security manner if we don't understand how to support them to do just that. Now, we can leverage this and identify who our security champions are. Who are the ones who will report reliably every single exercise, the ones who ask questions, ones who want to learn more? These people recognize that security is important for their work, and it's important to recognize who they are and recognize who sees security as a social responsibility. We need to support these people, encourage them, empower them. Shoot, start a security club, bring snacks, have swag, do what you need to do. So, have you ever wondered how your awareness training is going? If you have clear goals and clear intentions, you can create better metrics. You'll know what to measure once you're clear on what you're trying to achieve. Phishing exercises can help you achieve any number of goals, but you have to be very clear about what those goals are before you start. I want to turn to my co-host, and Lou, first to you, is intention something that you tend to be aware of in the work that you do and in the environment in which you do it?
Absolutely. Like, I think intentions are a key factor to ensuring that we understand the different facets of usage. Like, if we understand how people were intended to use something, we'll better understand how we can secure it, how we can make it more performant, how we can ensure that it's compliant. And I think these are really important things to use during an engineering process is to make sure that you're understanding the intent behind the system and how people are going to use it. Now, there's also the flip side as well, because obviously people use things on not, normally sometimes, especially software, and not intend to like how it's intended to be used. And so sometimes you can get yourself into trouble because the services can't handle it. So I guess there's also that, which is, goes on the other flip side of things, is ensuring that we also threat model and ensure that there's not a lot of attack vectors and people can't necessarily use or expand the service or system beyond its intent. And so that is a difficult challenge because now you're getting into a space where you do need the experience to be able to understand that. And so I think it's an important thing to do anytime you're developing something, anytime you're engineering something.
You know, I like that you said that. One of my favorite testing statements is that someone who says that their system is foolproof just hasn't tested it against a big enough fool. And I think that is something you would probably say that you have seen evidence of that in the work that you've done. Brian, I want to turn to you because you have done security at a number of different levels, and you've been responsible for both implementing security and setting policy for security. Have you found yourself in situations where you were being asked to develop security by people who were not clear on the intentions, and did that cause you problems?
Actually, yeah. The interesting thing is intentions are all good, but I like to use the word attention. If you're going to do training, if you're going to do exercises, how do you get your user population to quit going through them like zombies? You need to get their attention. Now, if you are an underfunded school or educational institution or you're a government agency, you have a little bit of rules blocking you from holding carrots in front of your user population. So for that, I'm actually going to take a page from my wife's management book. She goes and her organization actually collects a whole bunch of aluminum cans, and her people would turn them in, and that pot of money was used for Christmas parties or birthday parties and things like that. Now, in the government, we're not allowed to spend money on things like parties. It's been abused so badly over the years that it's forbidden for the most part. So we use tricky things like that, turning in aluminum cans to get a small pot of money so we can fund activities. You could easily fund the activities to have prizes or rewards for people that actually pay attention to your activities and practices and trials or whatever you want. I think getting the attention of your user population is just as important as making sure the intention of the activity is well known.
Well, I think both attention and intention are things that we need to keep in mind. And my intention right now is to move us along to the next segment of TWiET. For that, Lou, we'll turn it back over to you.
Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the TWiET, right? But before we get to our guest, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that is IT Pro TV. Now, you're a busy professional. I'm a busy professional. It can be difficult to learn new skills or develop skills to make a career change, right? Well, do you know how long well-qualified tech job candidates are on the job market? 10 days. It's not hiring. It's more like a bidding war out there. Well, IT Pro TV is an engaging and effective online IT professional training platform. They will help guide you into the IT career of your dreams with all the support you need to be successful. Now, you can take courses for network skills or security skills, Linux, Apple, and more, earn certificates in A+, CCNP, and so many more, including CompTIA. Now, IT Pro is actually the official video training partner for CompTIA and has 12 CompTIA on-demand courses. With over 5,800 hours of IT training, IT Pro TV is the best place to go for getting started or continuing your IT career. Now, I found a great feature of IT Pro TV for you and your teams. They have learning coaches. I run a large team, and I can tell you everyone has a different career goals and paths. Let IT Pro TV help you map your IT team's needs and goals to the IT Pro TV course library. Engage and grow the skill base of your team members through a corporate premium membership. Now, sign up for a premium membership and let experts guide you with setting goals and implementing IT training program to help you reach them. Now, go to IT Pro TV and start to explore different career paths, job resources, virtual labs, and practice tests so you can see yourself and the amazing opportunities you have to learn from the best professionals in the industry. Want to learn more? Go to IT Pro TV and catch their podcast, Tech Nano with Don Pezet. He's featuring industry guests and IT news recaps. And in July is IT Pro TV's CompTIA month. They have CompTIA-themed webinars, a free CompTIA training weekend, CompTIA-themed game show, and CompTIA guests on their podcasts, and more. Go to IT Pro TV and join a community of IT pros who are sharpening their skills the fun way. Go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use code enterprise30 to receive 30% off all consumer subscriptions. That's itpro.tv/enterprise and use code enterprise30 for an additional 30% off the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Tim Zonka. He's the CEO of Stackery. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thanks, Lou. Good to talk to you. Good to be on.
Thank you for being here. Now, before we get into all the enterprise goodness our audience loves to hear is people's origin stories, can you maybe take us on a journey through tech and what and how'd you actually end up at Stackery?
Yeah, I spent the whole first part of my career in tech doing solution architecture, kind of sales engineer work. And it gave me a great chance to really, I think, understand firsthand what matters most, which is how's it working for the IT teams that care about it and are implementing the software. So getting to work hand in hand with those folks as they selected and then implemented technology was, I think, a fantastic way to get started. Since then, I moved into kind of product marketing and have really spent the last couple decades focused on enterprise IT, and in particular, IT organizations that are looking to just build and ship better software. And most recently spent some time at Puppet, where I ran marketing and the alliances there. And that gave me a good chance to work with some of the largest IT teams on the planet as they were transforming, moving to the cloud, maturing their DevOps practices. And what's really exciting about making the move to Stackery late last year is that every team that we work with, they are the cloud platform team or the cloud engineering team. And they are doing really innovative work. And no longer are these kind of the days of like shadow IT where, hey, there's some people over in the corner looking into this cloud thing. It's become just so entrenched in any of the IT organizations that we all work with, around the planet. But they're just doing such innovative work. And so it's just a blast to work with those sorts of teams day in and day out.
So you kind of bring us into some good points here, because we're actually seeing a shift from the traditional on-prem to the cloud, obviously, and a lot of organizations are going to IaaS services, they're going to PaaS services. We see serverless being adopted, but not so much, because sometimes it's not as easy as just kind of uploading code and away you go. Can you maybe talk about what challenges people are having here and why we're not seeing as much adoption as quickly?
Yeah, I think what I hear in your question is there's kind of the fantastic promise of serverless, which is, you know, move fast, build new applications, get them up and running quickly, get them to your users quickly. They scale in a really elastic fashion. You're only paying for what you use. But I think what where we see some of the adoption having not been really matching, I think, that exciting promise is the way serverless teams work isn't necessarily set up to work just how traditional iTeams are set up. Meaning that even in a modern shop where they have cloud native technologies, maybe it's container based technologies, and they're practicing, you know, DevOps or whatever they call their modern SDLC, there still tend to be the dev and ops teams separate. And the processes, the practices set up are still, you know, there are still some set of people writing the code and still some set of people actually running the applications once they're out there. And they tend to be not only different roles, but different teams. The serverless teams that we work with that are most successful, they still have these different roles, but they're on the same team. They're all engineers, but they have the group of engineers that focus more on the architecture. They have the group of engineers on that team that focus more on the actual development and writing of the code, and then the group of engineers that focus on the operations bit. So the roles may be different, but they are all one team, and those are what the most successful serverless teams are doing. And I think though the practices are the same, or at least similar in so far as the SDLC practices, it's that organizational shift that's different that I think is, it ultimately, any sort of organizational change, it's hard. And those teams that have figured out that the value is there to go through that difficult change are the ones that are succeeding most with it. But it's surely something that will still take a while for the rest of the enterprises to pick up over time.
A lot of organizations where they have some existing solutions out there, and they're complex because they have, you know, they have code that they write, and then they have CI and CD loops, and they have to upload it, and they have to make sure that their infrastructure is scaling and all this stuff. And so, like you said, there's a great promise of serverless that kind of reduces some of that. But does it reduce all of it? Does it all go away?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't all go away. I think the biggest bit that goes away that is so alluring and gives organizations that adopt it the most value is not having to worry about the underlying infrastructure. And that means, I think it's really the costs associated with that. And the costs come in a few different flavors. It's the actual infrastructure. And then, you know, regardless if it's, you know, you're doing your in your own private cloud, you're doing it in someone else's cloud. But then the costs associated with the team that you need to put in place just to manage that infrastructure. And it's a talented, you know, those are sharp, talented folks that aren't inexpensive. And I think what serverless helps folks do is they're still going to organizations will still spend, you know, X amount of dollars on their development, both the tools that they need as well as the experts they need. And again, those experts can command a premium in the market. But the big difference is all of that money is spent on delivering value to customers and not on the underlying infrastructure. And so the most progressive customers we see, I was just talking with one of our largest customers, they're a large global financial services institution. And the person who runs the business unit, she says, hey, look, every penny as well as every minute that we have going toward this project, she wants on delivering value to customers, not on the underlying plumbing. And I think that's the biggest thing that folks, I think the biggest value, but everything else, there's still the same set of challenges. You're still defining your infrastructure as code. You still have to figure out what does our security look like and make sure we're embedding the right permissions, you know, at the onset. How do we scale repeatability and use of the patterns that we are blessed within the organization and that we want to make sure people rely on to adhere to security practices, compliance practices, things like that. There's still that same set of challenges to tackle, regardless if you're developing serverlessly or, you know, in any other set of underlying technology.
Right. Now, you just said something interesting because it says, okay, I'm getting rid of my infrastructure, potentially reducing the complexity of my DevOps. What about security? How does this help for security as well?
So my take is that it helps bring security a lot farther left in the process. And so I've heard a lot of different kind of monikers over the last few years where it's, you know, it's shifting security to the left, if it's DevSecOps, whatever people call it. It's this idea that the right sorts of security frameworks, the right sorts of kind of security, the way you have the permission set up across the different resources that are talking to one another, that those sorts of considerations can move way earlier in the process. And frankly, not only can they move way earlier in the process, but I think the biggest thing is they have to move earlier in the process. And the reason for that is one of the things that serverless does is in any other sort of DevOps or modern SDLC sort of practice, even if you're relying on kind of a containerized environment, or surely if it's a virtualized environment, notions of infrastructure as code. So a practice that has been, you know, proven to help organizations really adhere to and practice DevOps or whatever they call their modern SDLC, that's just a nice to have. With serverless, it's a must have. And so the result is, when you're defining your infrastructure as code from the very first moments, this is what we want the architecture of the application to look like. These are how the resources should talk to each other. This is what our environments look like. Once that's defined as infrastructure as code, that's the first moment that security can get baked into that architecture. So what we find is our customers that are doing this well, they have those security-minded engineers, you know, right in at the onset. And it just becomes part of the practice. So we think this helps organizations adhere to and start to practice a lot more modern set of security practices as part of their software development lifecycle.
Amazing. So we're going to go to Ed in a minute, but I just want to add one more question before I bring my co-host back in as well. And I'm big on tooling. I'm big on, you know, having that developer experience. And I one thing I noticed with your solutions, you have a lot of great tools. I saw some VS Code integration tooling, which was some really cool stuff there, doing visually piecing together templates for your serverless technology. What are some of the features that that you guys come with to kind of ease this into that model of serverless?
Yeah, it's a good question, because the features that people come to us for tend to be different than the ones that they end up using us for long term. Sure. You had mentioned our VS Code plugin, or we have a really fantastic visual way of understanding the architecture of your application. This is why people find us. You can quickly scaffold out your applications. It produces well architected AWS code in the background. It happens to be SAM in the background. And that's the reason people come to us. It helps us accelerate their adoption of serverless. The reason people stick around, though, is for stuff that, regardless if you're using that interface or not, helps them make sure that as they scale their practices of serverless development across a team, they could do so in a consistent way that has their security and compliance practices in mind. So you can define your environments in AWS. You can automate your CI/CD processes out across these environments, lock down who has access to see and do what across each of those. And those are the sorts of capabilities people tend to rely on us for over the long run, regardless if they're using kind of that reason they came to us, which is to accelerate that initial adoption of serverless.
When we come back, we do want to get into that more, and I want to bring my co-host back in as well. But before we get to all of that, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Barracuda. Now, Barracuda is the provider of cloud-enabled enterprise-grade security solutions that protect email, networks, data, and applications. Now, think about it. Suddenly, you have dozens, hundreds, maybe even thousands of employees working remotely, right? Well, each one of them getting tons of emails every day, making them vulnerable. Now, 91% of all cyber attacks start in the email. Spear phishing, ransomware, account takeover, conversational hijacking. Multiply that by how many employees you have times how many emails. One click on the wrong email can cost you money, customers, and even sometimes your reputation. Now, Barracuda researchers have seen a steady increase in the number of coronavirus-related spear phishing attacks since January, and they have been observing a recent spike of 667% in this type of attack since the end of February. Now, get the protection you need for your company with Barracuda Total Email Protection. It includes a lot of stuff here. Now, listen to it. All-in-one email security backups and archiving, AI-based protection from spear phishing, account takeover, and business email compromising, as well as automated incident responses that gives you options to quickly and efficiently address those attacks. Now, security awareness training is also available to help you and educate you and your organization and your workforce so your employees can be the first line of defense against attacks. Now, we have covered this couple times on Twiat. Now, in the current climate, the bad guys are targeting people using social engineering techniques. They impersonate organizations like the UN World Health Organization or even the US Center for Disease Control and Prevention to trick users into opening malicious emails. And then your user opens that code, that site that has that code on it, and their devices are now attackers. It's time to take back control of your security and ensure the safety and security of your business with Barracuda. To uncover threats hiding in your inbox, get a secure, free email threat scan of your Office 365 account risk-free at barracuda.com/enterprise. That's barracuda.com /enterprise. Barracuda, your journey secured. And we thank Barracuda for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Tim Zonka, CEO of Stackery, about serverless technology and a lot of its promises and some of the solutions out there. But I want to bring my co-host back in. Brian, I want to throw it over to you first. Brian?
I'm asking for an opinion. There's been a lot of comments that I've heard about some old timers talking about, gee, moving from these big, you know, server farms or a full operating system, infrastructure as a service, to containers or serverless in general. Their complaints have been, where's the safety net? Where are the controls? How do I monitor these things? What kind of tools does Stackery have to help these issues?
So Brian, I think it's a really good question. And I mean, I surely have a carry a bias toward what I see with our customers. So I can't speak to what this looks like in a containerized world, but I can in a serverless world. And one of the main use cases that we see our customers look to us for are the scenario that you just described, which is kind of refactoring their traditional applications. And one of the reasons they come to us is we allow them to take a really pragmatic approach to taking a monolithic application and breaking it apart into constituent microservices. So I'll touch on that first, and then I'll talk a little bit about the piece that you asked about insofar as kind of just securing and what I interpret as like securing and governing those. On the first bit, the role that serverless plays there, and in particular Stackery plays there, is we have a lot of customers that have lifted and shifted a monolithic or traditionally built application to the cloud. And it gives them one of the few benefits of the cloud. It gives them the scale or kind of the bursting, the ability to increase the load that their application can scale to. But it tends to cost at least the same, if not more. And then the other thing is they're no faster in getting updates out to their customers because it's the same thing that they had. They're just simply moving it to someone else's servers. Where they look to Stackery then, they also typically don't want to do a major rewrite of a revenue generating customer facing application. So what they look to Stackery for is we look at these applications with them and we say, well, let's take off problematic route by problematic route and just simply refactor those. And so these problematic routes tend to either be the ones that are the highest cost routes or the ones that don't scale very well or some mix of the two. And bit by bit, they'll refactor those routes serverlessly. And this, a lot of customers, they'll kind of take a strangler pattern approach to doing this that gives them that pragmatic route by route refactoring approach. In the end, then, they may have entirely refactored their application, but it hasn't been a massive project where they had to, you know, disappear for a while, rebuild an application and relaunch it. They've just been kind of bit by bit refactoring this. The end result is then it's entirely based on a constituent set of managed services coming from their cloud provider like AWS or something like that. And now not only do they get that bursting and that scalability, the cost associated with our customers tend to see about a 90% cost reduction because of that, because they're just paying for that bursting that they're actually using. And they're also not managing the underlying infrastructure. And then they also see just the speed gains that you don't see if you're just doing a lift and a shift, in that you can go ahead and update the application bit by bit. It allows these teams to iterate much faster. So it's kind of the first thing. The second thing, once you do that, your notion of or kind of the question around, well, what does that mean from like a pragmatic or security or kind of a governance perspective? Now that you have each of these constituent routes or these resources talking to one another, it's really straightforward to say, well, how do they work? What's the governance applied to each of these, and how do we ensure that the right sort of thing is happening? So I guess my opinion and our opinion is it's that move in particular that's a fantastic reason to consider serverless for taking those mission critical, you know, revenue generating, customer facing apps, but refactoring them in a really pragmatic way so you get the best of the cloud, not, you know, someone else's servers, but you're not really getting the best of the cloud.
Well, I was looking at your website, and I've got a couple of questions based on what you've said and what your website shows. And one of the things that I'm really interested in is looking at the use case for your services, your product. Do you find that you're seeing your services used primarily with centralized enterprise development teams, or are some of the business units taking over application development? You know, you talk a lot about the way that you can concentrate on business logic rather than the programming logic. So are you seeing business units start to get involved using products like yours?
We are. The example that I provided earlier, this large financial services organization, it was a business unit that drove the purchase and is driving the implementation of Stackery and their first set of SaaS apps that are being run through Stackery. That said, it's not. It's surely not over half. It's a trend that we're starting to see. It's a trend that when we do see it, we've done it enough to know how to really work with those people so they understand, you know, what does it take to kind of deploy and go through a procurement and then implementation process for their new set of applications that are done serverlessly. But I would say by and large, and I'm, you know, just shooting from the hip here, but 70-75% of our customers, our implementations, they're still being done through central IT. And the thing that surprises me, though, is really how prolific serverless usage is within kind of these cloud teams within central IT. I thought when I first joined Stackery late last year, I expected to have many more conversations where people are saying, hey, we're, you know, our team's expanding into serverless. We're new to this. Like, what is this whole thing? And should we actually do it or not? I don't have those conversations. The people that come to us, it's usually they say, hey, we've been doing serverless for a year or so now. We believe it's the way forward for these set of projects, but it's harder than we thought it would be. And so people said, you know, we should check Stackery out. But those groups, Curtis, to your point, I would say it's still the vast majority is on the central IT side and always in some sort of cloud group, you know, cloud platform team, cloud engineering team.
Okay, that makes a great deal of sense. And the next question is related to that just a bit, because you were talking about a lift and shift. You were talking about all kinds of what amount to redevelopment process. It's taking applications and rebuilding, redeveloping. Do you have a sense from your customers how much of the way they're using your products are, in fact, those redevelopment versus developing new applications? And do you see any difference in the way they're using it for the two uses?
Yeah, our breakdown is roughly like the three main use cases that we see. The one that I mentioned before, that sort of modernization. So it's not only that they've migrated, but they want to modernize. That's somewhere around 40-ish% of our customers. The other 40, or the next 40 rather, is it's just net new greenfield applications. So there isn't the burden of kind of legacy code that they need to worry about. They have a new project, a new set of applications that they're delivering. And those are about equal in weight for the amount of time that we spend working with our customers on those. And it's about 40% in each of those categories. The remaining 20% is what I call innovation around the edges. And these are organizations that have some sort of enterprise application. It might be something that they built. It in many cases, it's actually something that's provided by a cloud offering. But it's a cloud offering that's started 10 years or so ago, and it's become a prolific and well entrenched, established enterprise offering within that organization. And so they can't go and customize the core. And so what they do is they innovate around the edges and they use serverless technologies to do that. And that accounts for about 20% of our business. So it's a good mix between the refactoring of existing code and building net new stuff. And then there's that last smaller category of kind of almost like a mix of the two.
Very good. Well, thank you for that. I think it is getting time for us to turn things back over to Lou, because I suspect we're running short on time. Lou, take it away.
That's Tim, thank you so much for being here. We are running a little bit low on time. I did want to give you maybe a chance to tell the folks at home where they can go, maybe learn more about Stackery and how they can get started on it.
Yeah, so just go to stackery.io, and from there you can sign up for free. You can actually, without even signing up, you can go ahead and model out an application and see what it's like to understand what a serverless application would look like, to architect it, to develop it, and ultimately to deliver it to your cloud environment. So stackery.io, and you'll get all you need right there. And again, if I'm kind of wrapping up, at least for my portion, thanks, Lou. It's been great to join you. Thanks also, Curtis and Brian, for your questions. It's been really a pleasure to be part of the show.
Thanks again. Appreciate you being here. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the best AIM enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your device to Twyatt. But I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. This is a team effort, and we have the best team in the market. That's right. My co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Brian Cheebert. What's going on for you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you?
Well, thank goodness that flight of Ospreys are done. Wow, those things can shake the house. I am on Twitter, ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, and I'd love to hear from you. You can see what's going on with me. If you want, feel free. I am Cheebert, spelled C-H-E-E-B-E-R-T, at Twyatt.com. My students had a Dilbert naming convention, and they did all decided unanimously I had to be cheaper. But why don't you instead send email to twyatt@twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts, and we'd love to hear from you. Show ideas, you name it. Toss us a line, and we'd love to hear from you.
Thanks, Cheaper. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the senior editor over there at Dark Reading. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week? Where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, you can certainly find me at Dark Reading, and especially over at the edge of Dark Reading, doing a lot of getting ready for Black Hat and DEF CON. Black Hat's coming up in about 3 weeks, and I'm talking to a fair number of the people who are going to be presenting. There are some great presentations that are going to be happening there. Going to bring you previews of as many of those as I can, and then we'll be covering the show live as it goes on virtually. In the meantime, I'm also talking to people. Like I said, I've got conversations coming up with DJI on drone security. I've already had a conversation on C programming practices for better applications and better means more secure. So lots of great stuff. I will always be tweeting about those at KG4GWA. Also, you can catch me on Instagram, Kurt_Franklin. One way or another, please let me know what you think of my pieces and what you would like to see us cover Dark Reading.
Thank you, Curtis. Like I said, best team in the business. Well, folks, I also thank you as well, because you are the person who drops in each and every week to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and to listen to catch up on your enterprise news, right? Well, go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, and as well as the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version or video version of your choice and listen in on any one of your devices. That's why, especially on any one of your podcast applications. We're on all of them. Now, it's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news, so go ahead and subscribe. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers. Give the gift of Twyatt, because you know what? Sharing Twyatt will also bring them up on those IT news as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available during the day, especially this time, Friday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do the show live. You can check it out at live.twit.tv. There we do the show, and you can see the behind the scenes. You can see how the pizza's made. Come see, enjoy the show, and see how we sometimes, have a lot of fun. Now, also, if you're going to watch the show live, come to the chat room as live. We have a really great chat room, a bunch of great characters, some great questions in there at irc.twit.tv. There we get some great content. We have some good discussions during the show, and we really love to have you in there if you can watch the show live. Now, if you can't be part of the live show and you can't watch the show live, we also have still obviously subscribe, and we have a great conversation and discussion over at our Twit community as well, twit.community. Great website. We have the co-hosts out there. We have the guests. We have sometimes we have great discussions about technology. All the hosts on Twit are out there So definitely check that out, twit.community, and join the 24/7 discussion. Remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Plus, of course, I have great conversations with people like you. And, of course, I talk about what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. And if you're interested in seeing some of that stuff, you go to developers.microsoft.com/office. There you'll see the latest and greatest ways to customize your Office solutions to make it more productive for you and your organization. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week to do This Week in Enterprise Tech. We couldn't do this show without them and all their support. I also want to thank all the engineers and staff at Twit. They support us each and every week, and we couldn't do this show without them. And of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chi one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he is also our tireless producer. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do this show without him. So thanks again, Chibert, for all of your support. And before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Jeff. Jeff, thank you so much for being here, my friend. Now, let me think. Are you still alone in the studio, or is it you're starting to get a little bit more people rolling in here and there?
No, we're looking at the stats, and things are still going up. So I am the only one here today in this wonderful studio. I really miss the hustle bustle and setting up all the cameras, getting the shows ready with all the other great people here. But today I'm here by myself, so looks like it's going to be that way for a while. But really enjoying what I'm doing, and I really enjoy this show. Another great guest.
Me too. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, folks, I am Micah Sargent, co-host of Tech News Weekly right here on the Twit Network. Yes, Tech News Weekly is a show we do every week, Jason Howell and myself, where we talk to people who are making and are breaking the tech news. That's right. It's journalists, it's inventors, it's app makers, it's everybody who's bringing the tech news in a given week. It's all the stuff you want to know about in bite-sized chunks in a fantastic package. So be sure to subscribe. It's twit.tv/TNW. We'll be right back.